Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. I'm turning the intro over to somebody who is a domestic abuse survivor and one of the strongest women I know. It's my mom. She worked really hard to get this recording out and get it just right. So once she's done with the intro, I'll pick up with the rest of the show. And I'll go ahead and apologize now. My voice is not what you're used to. I'm a little under the weather. But I appreciate you understanding. Okay, here's my mom.
When I think of domestic abuse, the first thing that comes into my mind is spousal abuse. When I hear the name John Battaglia, I think of a sadistic, vengeful person causing harm to the mothers of his children by savagely beating them and then committing an unspeakable crime, shooting his precious little girls. The murder of his two daughters makes it malicious. But what makes it vengeful is committing those murders while their mother listened. It's bone-chilling to hear her calling 911, fearing for the safety of her children. 911 was implemented in 1989. It had been in use for 12 years. I often wonder, how did one survive the abuse back then without 911? It was simple. You dialed zero, and the operator would connect you to the correct department, and the abused party would hope they would be alive when the police would arrive. To even live to tell about how one survived the night before was a huge miracle in itself. It's a shame that it cost Faith and Liberty Battaglia their lives to get the wheels in motion to try to deter tragedies such as these. My mom had a saying when I was growing up, "You weren't the first, nor will you be the last." Sadly, even in the year 2017, small progress has been made since 1989. These little girls weren't the first nor the last to be murdered by a parent. John failed to protect them, and the system failed to protect John's first wife, who endured extensive physical abuse. I was so appalled and saddened by all the events leading up to the senseless deaths of these babies. Having been in an abusive relationship myself, it made me remember calling the police and being told there was nothing they could do. I feared for my life and that of my three children. Life without your children is a prison of its own. If you don't believe me, ask someone who's lost a child. Okay, on to the show.
John Battaglia Jr. was born on August 2, 1955, on a military base in Alabama. The eldest of five children, he would be brought up in a strict Catholic household. He was closest to his mother, but yearned for the affection, acceptance, and love of his father. His father was a hard-nosed disciplinarian and felt that punishment dealt out was earned by anyone who disobeyed him. That included his wife, Julia Christine. She brought John Jr. peace. Her presence was badly needed in his life. But the years of abuse from his father took a toll on her. They moved often since John Sr. was in the military, and they eventually landed in New Jersey. She became an alcoholic who suffered from severe depression. She was told by John Sr. that he would be committing her to a psychiatric facility. She went into a frenzy after hearing this news and had to be sedated by a local physician. She woke the next day and shared with her son that she was not ready for that kind of help. They said their goodbyes and he went to school. Julia drove along the Hudson River about 100 miles and pulled over. She walked to the edge of the cliff and looked out at the Hudson. She pulled a 9mm out of her purse and put it to her temple. She was found hours later, deceased. She left a note to her family describing the debilitating depression she suffered from and expressed her love for her five children. After his mother's death, John Jr. began experiencing severe mental anguish and violent outbursts. The outbursts only got worse after his father remarried and adopted a new stepson. He decided to follow a couple of bands in 1976, as opposed to continuing his collegiate career. He was introduced to cocaine and found that it calmed his outbursts. He began selling it and eventually was arrested and charged with intent to distribute. He joined the Marine Corps in 1977 to try and start over. That seemed to be a pattern for John, starting over. He moved to Dallas to live with his father while he earned his CPA license. This is where he met a young attorney by the name of Michelle Laborde. John was attractive and outgoing, which made him attractive to Michelle. He asked her out, and she said yes, but she told him that she had a 3-year-old son named Billy from a previous marriage. John wasn't fazed. They continued their relationship. John would spend more and more time with Billy. Michelle loved this about him. She loved that he accepted Billy as his own. She never saw any of the angry outbursts that John experienced in his young adulthood. She wouldn't see her first warning sign until a trip to New Orleans in 1985. That evening, as they were driving, a group of aggressive teenagers cut John off and slowed down in front of him. This caused him to press down on his brakes, hard. Enraged, John screamed for Michelle to pull the duffel bag up from the floor so that he could get his gun. She refused, and he screamed at her again. As they fought over the bag, he began weaving through the lanes. This frightened her, and she began screaming at him to stop and calm down. Otherwise, he was going to kill them both. He passed the group of teenagers and cursed at them. Michelle made up her mind that she couldn't be with someone who could explode in an instant. They arrived back to Dallas, and she found out she was pregnant. Having been a single mother before, she didn't want to go through that again. She told John that she was pregnant, and he immediately proposed. She was reluctant to accept his proposal and shared this with her mother in a letter. Her mother wrote back to stop being foolish and accept the proposal. Little did Michelle know that following her mother's advice would have severe consequences. They married in a civil ceremony in April of 1985. 30 days later, John disappeared. Michelle was confused and heartbroken over this. 3 days after vanishing, he called and said that he had been with his previous girlfriend, Janet. He shared that he had broken off his engagement to her right before they began dating. Michelle demanded to meet her and make sure everything was over. John told Janet that he had just been confused and that he no longer loved her and was moving on with Michelle. Little did Michelle know, John was plotting on leaving her after the baby was born and taking it to raise with Janet. He first attacked her when she was 5 months pregnant. They were in the process of moving, and she asked for help packing. John told her that the majority of the items were hers, and that he didn't see why he needed to help. She then approached him again and asked for him to help. He ran towards her and choked her, saying that he would help when he was good and ready. She couldn't breathe and was frightened. He released her, and she ran to the bathroom to calm down and wipe her face. She had never seen the sight of him before, at least not directed towards her, and she didn't know what to do. John was growing more and more irritable each day, and he wasn't taking it out on her all the time. He started taking it out on Billy. One night, she was fixing dinner and heard Billy cry out. John had thrown him against the wall when he had asked to play a little bit longer. He didn't seem fazed by Michelle's anger as she screamed at him to never do that again. But weeks later, he would kick Billy in the rear, causing him to be lifted off the ground. He then retreated to the bedroom to watch TV, where Michelle followed him and yelled again. Her threats fell on deaf ears. On November 10th, 1985, their daughter, Laura Julia Battaglia, was born. The abuse of Billy ceased that day. This is an MO common with domestic abusers. They will often focus their attention on the abuse of another loved one, since the one they want to harm is pregnant. John's outbursts began to occur on cue. Every 3 months, he would violently react, and the household was put on edge. It wasn't until John began beating her while she was holding Laura that she decided enough was enough. Despite John being an attentive father, he didn't care who got in his way when he was trying to harm Michelle. One time, he hit her so hard and came at her with such force that she dropped Laura and the baby hit her head on the wall. She feared now more than ever for the safety of her children and made up her mind to leave him. John would make it difficult for Michelle after their divorce, constantly stalking her and breaking into her home. He would terrorize the nanny by busting through the front door after Michelle left for work. She was beginning to show signs of severe anxiety. She wasn't eating, and she was looking over her shoulder all the time. John seemed to know where she was at all times, and would show up at random hours of the day and night. She found out later that he had bugged her home phone. She bought a gun and decided she was through with his taunts and threats. One night, he began trying to kick in her front door. She pulled the gun out and yelled at him that she had a gun and she would use it. He left. He was terrorizing her and using the court system against her, because the court system did nothing to protect her or her children. When she asked that visits with John be supervised, a judge told her, "He didn't hurt the children, only you, so he's not a danger to them." This response infuriated Michelle, and she began working on ways to keep John out of her life for good. He had ruined her credit by stealing her credit cards and hiding bills from her. Her car had been in the shop due to an accident on the freeway, where somebody was weaving in and out of traffic following her and then hitting her bumper, causing her to tailspin. She had both of her children in the car, but luckily there were no injuries. As a result, she was forced to take public transportation due to a mix-up with the insurance company. John would on occasion be waiting for her outside the front door of her house, and at one point, when she ordered him to leave or she would call the police, he pushed her down the stairs and then rushed off. The next day, she got off the bus and began walking with her children towards home. A neighbor named Bonnie spotted what happened next. John was wearing only white tennis shorts when he began to beat Michelle. She was defenseless against him. He kept punching her face, back, and neck repeatedly, savagely beating her until Bonnie ran over to tell him to stop his attack. He looked back down at Michelle, who was bloody and slipping in and out of consciousness, and he hit her one last time before leaving. This knocked her totally unconscious. Michelle was rushed to the hospital, where doctors examined her and found that her jaw had been dislocated and her nose was broken. Unbelievably, her beating was classified as a misdemeanor, which meant that John, at best, faced probation. This had not worked in the past to keep him away from her or to curb his behavior of stalking. She reviewed the Texas Penal Code and found that her broken nose elevated the assault to a felony. She requested that charges be filed against him immediately, but John quickly posted bail and was back to stalking her and terrorizing her. Eventually, she moved to Baton Rouge under the cover of night with her children, but a judge in Texas ordered that Laura should have unsupervised visits with her father monthly. This infuriated Michelle, but she had no choice but to comply. His felony charges were downgraded after he persuaded Michelle that counseling had worked on him. This was wholeheartedly untrue. In 1990, he met Mary Jean Pearl, a 28-year-old attractive woman working for her parents' antique business. A native Texan, she had her fair share of eligible bachelors and was not impressed with those who she dated in the past. They were interested in taking care of her and making her a homemaker, but she was not interested in that type of lifestyle. She didn't need the support. She was a child of wealthy parents and wanted for nothing. A man could not offer her anything other than their love. That was all she wanted. Mary Jean was instantly attracted to John. He had sharp eyes and he was accomplished. They began a whirlwind romance and she fell hard in love with him. They dated for 3 months when she announced to her family that her and John were engaged. They planned to wed the following year, in 1991. Her brother was concerned with John's personality. He seemed to overshadow the considerate nature of his sister. Mary Jean ignored her brother's concerns and kept her plans to marry John. Everyone, from the priest to her parents, felt that the union was doomed. Mary Jean was controlling in a way and refused to include John in the wedding planning. They scrapped the Catholic wedding that John requested and instead got married in the living room of their new home. She was relieved to finally be married to the man she loved so deeply. She wasn't expecting that a small spat would cause him to explode in the way that he did. She had defended his past actions against Michelle. She was clearly in the wrong, when all John was trying to do was establish regular visits with Lori. Much like Michelle on the New Orleans trip, she chalked up his outburst to an isolated incident and told herself that it would not occur again. She had only known happy and healthy marriages and had no experience with domestic abuse, so she didn't know the warning signs. This would change after saying I do to John. 2 months after their nuptials, she found out that she was pregnant. Her first daughter, Mary Faith Battaglia, was born on January 9, 1992. John was an attentive father when she was born. He spent nights cuddling her and feeding her, and Mary Jean was impressed with her husband and was thrilled that he was such a loving father. The house that John shared with Mary Jean became a point of contention because it belonged solely to Mary Jean. She was gifted the real estate by her parents as a wedding gift, and John felt emasculated. He surprisingly did not batter her. Instead, he was verbally and mentally abusive towards her. He called her fat, stupid, and a bitch regularly. She often asked him to go to counseling so that his anger could be controlled, and this only caused him to increase the harshness in his words, if that was even possible. Like most women in this situation, she kept this hidden from her friends and family. It was embarrassing, and she couldn't connect how something like this could happen to someone like her. Michelle was relieved that John had a new woman in his life. She was finally free from his harassment and stalking. He had focused all of his attention, energy, and anger on his new family. She worried about Mary Jean, but when Michelle would ask how things were, Mary Jean would simply reply, "Great. My friends tell me I'm very good for John. I calm him down." But Michelle saw under that mask and let the subject go. John's work life was marred with controversy. He was sued for sexual harassment by a coworker, which caused him to sue his female boss for sexual harassment due to her vulgar language. He agreed to drop the suit if his coworker dropped hers against him. Everything with John was a battle. He was highly disliked by many of his peers. However, John always remained unscathed by their complaints. They would welcome their second child, a daughter, Liberty May, in January of 1997. He doted on her as much as he had faith, and Mary Jean wished that she could elicit the same love and care that John had shown for his children, just once. She wanted to move to Highland Park, a very affluent city outside of Dallas. They found a home with a big enough backyard for their growing family, and once again, the house belonged to Mary Jean. His verbal abuse of her intensified, and she was concerned that her two daughters would accept this treatment from their future partners. She was terrified of this notion, and despite her want to keep her family together, she just couldn't handle it anymore. After a particularly nasty spat, she ordered him out of the house. He expressed that he didn't understand what the big deal was, and she said that it wasn't this instance, it was all of the instances combined, and she just was done, and he needed to leave. He hugged his daughters goodbye and decided to move to Deep Ellum, a neighborhood inside Dallas. Deep Ellum is eclectic and artsy, which is right up John's alley. He had an interest in art and music, and even wanted to quit his job to become an artist. When he was married to Michelle, she objected, and this led to an altercation. In December of 1999, Mary Jean, Faith, and Liberty were celebrating their first Christmas without John. Although he was expected later in the day, they enjoyed the peaceful time together. In typical John fashion, he arrived early to the house in order to upset Mary Jean's plans. He knew that she had everything timed perfectly, and showing up more than an hour early to pick up the girls for church would surely infuriate her. The younger girls were excited to see their older sister. They were eager to show her the presents they had gotten for Christmas, but once they saw their father waiting in the doorway, Faith looked to her mother and asked, "Is it okay if he comes in?" Mary Jean was strong-willed and got a protective order against John after essentially evicting him from their house. She wanted to have a safe place for her children, and in order to get that, John couldn't be around, and the protective order stated as much. She reluctantly invited John and Lori into the home. He began looking through the gifts the girls got and was furious. Mary Jean had essentially robbed him of his house and income. She was oblivious to his boiling rage. She asked Lori if she would like to come over for dinner, but John quickly retorted, "If I'm not welcome, you're not staying." She expected this response from him and began to walk upstairs to get the girls ready for church. She felt a presence behind her and noticed John was following her upstairs. Her stomach sank, and she knew this was not good. He accused her of hiding things from him and taking everything away from him. She refused to go there with him, and so she didn't play into his drama. He was triggered by her back-talking and lunged at her. She had time to react and went face-first into Liberty's bed. He began punching the back of her head and back. She managed to scream for her daughters to call 911. He continued his beating by holding her tautly by the hair and kicking her in the face, stomach, head, arms, and legs. All three of his children ran into the room and began to cry and scream at their father. They begged him to stop his attack on their mother, who was now a bloody mess. Her beautiful silk pajamas were soaked in blood. He released her and left, abandoning Lori. Police arrived to take statements of the attack. Mary Jean knew her Christmas was now ruined, and it was all because of John and his anger. She was shocked to learn that her attack was considered a Class A misdemeanor in the state of Texas. After the attack, Mary Jean tried to finalize her divorce. The battle with John seemed never-ending. He was always fighting or complaining about the injustices he suffered because of the pending divorce. He took his anger out on Mary Jean by putting Faith and Liberty in the middle of their arguments. At one point, he left this message on their answering machine, "Girls, I'm sorry for whatever may be coming down the road for you. It may be very bad." John didn't care that this message confused his daughters or terrified their mother. This call violated the protective order Mary Jean had against him, so she contacted the Highland Park Police Department to report the violation. John was found guilty of assaulting her and was ordered to pay a fine and serve 2 years probation. Although not what Mary Jean expected, she was relieved that the divorce was going to be finalized. The custody schedule had been set, and John was allowed to visit the girls, unsupervised, Easter 2001. All three girls, Lori, Faith, and Liberty, gathered at Mary Jean's house for dinner. Not wanting to exclude Lori from the gift exchange, she gave her a card with $50. When John found it, he called Mary Jean and left a message that said, "The next time you give my daughter $50, why don't you tell her how you screwed her out of her fucking college fund, you fucking pig? How do you feel, pig?" She contacted Highland Park PD once again to report John for his violation. It would take nearly 2 weeks before a warrant was issued for his arrest. He was growing antsy. He knew that his probation could be revoked due to this latest blunder, and that the police were likely looking for him. On Wednesday, May 2nd, 2001, it was his day to pick up his girls. The day was gloomy for them. They had spoken to him earlier in the day, and he told them that he wouldn't see them for about a year, since their mom was trying to get him locked up. The girls grew concerned and lamented that they didn't understand why their father just couldn't be good. Mary Jean tried to comfort her daughters while getting them ready for their visit. They were scheduled to meet at 6 p.m. They piled into the car hesitantly, and Mary Jean couldn't shake how she just found Liberty. Moments earlier, the little girl was hiding under her bed, shaking and terrified. She had tears pooling in her eyes, but her mother managed to convince her everything was all right. John was 25 minutes late to the drop-off, and the girl sulked into his truck. Mary Jean felt terrible that they had to go, but she didn't want to start another fight, or possibly have another altercation with him. He glared at her as he drove off, and she noticed the girls looked despondent and sad. John drove the girls back to his Deep Ellum neighborhood and told them he had to stop by his loft to change clothes. When they got upstairs, he quickly changed his clothes and walked out of his room and into the living room where the girls were waiting. He urged the girls to tell them what their mother had planned for him. They said they didn't know, and he said, "Let's ask her." When Mary Jean did not pick up her phone, John contacted her mother to relay a message. The girls needed to ask her a question, and it was very important that she call them back. Doris Pearl called her daughter and told her about the strange call she received from John minutes earlier. Exacerbated, Mary Jean returned the call, and it would change her life forever. She held the receiver close to her ear to wait for her daughter's question. But before Faith could get the words out, John bellowed, "Ask her! Ask her!" Faith managed to say, "Mommy, why do you want Daddy to have to go to jail?" Mary Jean sighed and prepared a response, but then she heard screams and Faith yelling, "No, Daddy, don't! Oh, please, no, Daddy, don't do it! No, no, no!" Then a gun blast echoed in her ear. She screamed for the girls to run for the door. Liberty, who was listening on the speakerphone, tried to comply and began running towards the door, but John caught up to her and shot her. He then picked up the phone and said, "Merry fucking Christmas, Mary Jean," and hung up. He walked over to both girls and placed the nuzzle of the Glock against their heads and pulled the trigger. Mary Jean made it to the lofts where John murdered their daughters before the police arrived. She spotted a patrol car and flagged it down, but John had left soon after shooting the girls a final time. When they entered the loft, they found the bodies of Faith and Liberty Battaglia sprawled on the floor. They had suffered numerous gunshot wounds. John would later be caught as he finished getting a tattoo, two roses, to commemorate the memory of his daughters. During the time he left the apartment and was found by police, he had left another haunting message on his daughter's answering machine. It said, "Hi girls, I just want to tell you how very, very brave you were, and I hope you are resting in a better place now. I wish that you had nothing to do with your mother. She's evil and vicious and stupid." The girls were laid to rest on May 5th, 2001, and Mary Jean was forced to pick up the pieces that lay broken. John was charged with 2 counts of capital murder. His defense team attempted to say that he suffered from bipolar disorder and was not fully aware of his actions. The prosecution countered that John was seeking the ultimate revenge on Mary Jean and killed his 2 daughters as a way to get back at her. The jury deliberated for only 19 minutes before finding him guilty on both counts. He was set to be executed by lethal injection. On March 30th, 2016, he was granted a stay of execution after the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a stay so that the court could examine his attorney's claims that he was not mentally competent to be executed. The stay happened just 7 hours before he was set to die. His execution date was then scheduled for December of 2016, but was given a stay yet again due to the same issues. For now, his execution date is scheduled for March of 2017. As a result of their tragic deaths, on September 1st, 2001, the Battaglia Visitation Law was passed. It required that a parent's history of abuse with either a spouse or their child must be considered in a judge's decision to grant unsupervised visits with their children. 2 years before John was set to die, he sat down for an interview with the Dallas Morning News. Here's what he had to say about the murders.
"But I had a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old and a suicidal mother. So I stuck it out for another 5 years, and then a piece of shit just turned on me like you wouldn't believe. And she ruined my life, she ruined my daughter's life, and she ruined my daughter Christy's life.
And so, why do you feel like it was a setup? So,
because I told him I didn't want to go get my kids because I knew I was in trouble.
Why become violent with your daughters and not your wife if your wife is the one you ran?
I don't know. I don't know. That's not the situation that I understand. Okay.
I mean, do you feel like you were killing them to get back at your?
I don't feel like I killed.
You what?
I don't feel like I killed.
So why did you?
I do not know why. If you read what I wrote, you will find out that I am a little bit in the blank about what happened. Now, a lot of people wanted to have me say certain things, and I was given lots of nice drugs in the county jail, and I was given lots and lots of information that I didn't necessarily know, and after a while, I started repeating.
Do you think about the times you've had with them? Do you worry about where they are now?
No, I don't worry about where they are now. Why would I worry about where they are now?
Where do you think they are?
Where we all are. We're all here, all gone at the same time. Nobody should be worried about it. People do, but that's people that have their own philosophies and their own way of dealing with existence. I have pictures of them up in my house. I have them on my table. I have them on the wall. I have them around me all the time. There's one I like where I'm holding Faith and Christy. Thanksgiving prayer team was taking the picture. You'll see that on my website. I'm wearing a t-shirt and a leather vest, and I think Faith is 3, Christy's like 6, and Liberty's in Mary Jean's stomach about 8 or 9 months, you know, pregnant when she took that picture.
And what do you think about
your best little friend? The nicest little kid you ever know. I want you to do that now.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review on iTunes. It really helps us out. You can follow us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, Instagram TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out this cool true crime podcast I stumbled upon. It's called Misconduct, a true crime podcast. Each week, Eileen and Colleen, who also happen to be related, discuss the facts, the theories, and opinions on cases ranging from mysterious disappearances to miscarriages of justice. It's really great, so check them out on iTunes or follow them on Twitter. We're also going to be at CrimeCon this year, so if you're planning on attending and you haven't bought your tickets, be sure to use our code TCFCPod20 for 20% off of your order. Until next time.